Welcome to Bodhisattva Conversations With. I'm Julia Kai, and I interview people about aspects of their life that are or have been significant to them.
Today, I am with Claire Watkinson, and I am very, very happy to be with Claire because actually this podcast is all part of what she's going to be talking about, which is creativity and self-expression, which I'm very, very much looking forward to hearing everything she has to say. Claire has an incredible CV. It's very, very impressive. Whether she shares it or not, we will see. So I'm not going to tell you all of her background because she's in a chrysalis phase in her life. She just turned 40. She actually is an awesome writer. She has a fabulous, fabulous blog. It's called Sold You. And I'll put the link at the bottom. And I absolutely love, Claire sends me texts, which are a work of art. And I enjoy reading them so much because she is an absolute master of the written word. So what we're going to do is talk to her about this journey into creativity, into self-expression. And there's a wealth of it to investigate with her because she also does aerial hoop, which she's actually given me a fabulous book. So, you know, I think some of you know I'm practicing handstands, about how to do handstands, the yogi handstander. So it was one of the best presents I've ever had, Claire. So hello.
Hello, Julia. Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. Actually, I'm also delighted to let you know that you are hereby taking my official first interview virginity.
Well, that is something.
And I couldn't have hoped for it to have gone to a more wonderful person.
I love it. So, Claire, this journey, this chrysalis phase, can you feel, you said the word chrysalis to me when we were talking about your introduction. What does the chrysalis represent to you or feel like?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Well, what it represents is a time in my life of not having a clear idea of how, of the direction things are going to take, but feeling the growth of possibilities and potentials, and a process of allowing that to happen in its own time without forcing it. But the difficulty with that is it feels very uncomfortable a lot of the time, and it's not what I expected. And I think my expectation, and this is of course part of my perhaps conditioning, was that I would leave my previous job and career and very quickly solve the problem of what I'm doing next and leap into that and be trundling along quite merrily by now on a new path. And actually that's not how it's panning out, which of course is not how creativity works anyway. It's a process of percolation and an alchemy that takes its own time, but that requires, particularly in this context of an epidemic and the lockdown and a loss of most of my income, it requires a huge amount of presence and faith and trust that everything will work out, even though this is the kind of leap I've never really taken before, in that there isn't a visible net at the moment. I'm still in that free fall between things. So it's, sometimes it's really exciting and sometimes it's terrifying.
There is that quote, isn't there? And I can't remember who said it, but it's leap and the net will catch you. And I can't remember who wrote that. You would probably know. Do you know John somebody?
I can't remember either. Yes, leap and the net will appear.
Leap and the net will appear. So this is the first time that you've leapt as such in this way with your creativity. But tell us, has this yen for creativity, this creativity within writing, within your aerial hoop, has it always been there? So tell us about it from its inception, because if it's always been there, how has it woven its way in your life up until now at 40 years old you've taken a leap of it being more of your whole life, I think. Is that right?
I hope, yes. We'll see how it pans out. As a child, I was very creative and imaginative, and my lifelong biggest passion and pastime, I suppose, has always been reading. But as a child, I liked to create things, I liked to make things, I liked to be in imaginative worlds. But growing up, I think I responded very quickly to the sense of academic achievement being a safety line, a kind of harness of, this was how I knew I was safe in the world, when I was getting approval from teachers and parents. And so I quite quickly absorbed the message as well that that was the way to get by in life, that was the way to be safe. And I suppose developed a belief that I'm only just beginning to confront now, really, that creativity is a self-indulgent pursuit, and of no worth to other people. So I think I was looking, as I grew up, to be of service to others, but from a place of fear, not from a place of strength. I thought that was where I would find my self-worth. So when it came time to choose my what I was going to study at university, I initially had a place to study English literature at UCL. And then at the very last minute, I had a crisis of conscience and thought, that's far too self-indulgent, that's of no use to anybody. I'll always be reading and writing anyway, so I ought to study something that can be of more help to the world. And so that was my kind of deviation from what I think was probably my true path, although of course our journey brings us to where we need to be, whatever. And so I took a year out, went off to be a community services volunteer, actually, in Scotland. And then, armed with my A-level results, was able to get a place at Oxford University to study something called human sciences, which I thought would be a way of being of service to the world. I thought there was more potential with that. And so I then spent 3 years studying human sciences, and from there ended up going down quite a scientific path. So I went on to do an MSc in Demography and Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and then a PhD in Epidemiology here in Cambridge, and so had completely separated from a creative path in terms of my career and my profession at that point, but all along harbouring this quite secret inner desire to write, first and foremost. And interestingly, I then spent 5 years labouring away at this PhD, which was it was based on statistics and modelling, it's very interesting looking back at that now, because maths and anything science actually was one of my most feared and disliked subjects growing up, but somehow I'd taken myself into this path of thinking that was where I should therefore go. And after 5 years, I got to a point where I realized it's time to cut my losses, I'm not on the right path here. And that was very difficult to admit to myself, let alone anybody else, because of course it was such a prestigious place to be. And the currency of everybody surrounding me was to have this PhD and to finish it, especially after so much work. But circumstances were such, the decision almost made itself. And I gave up that PhD almost at the last hurdle, and then leapt into a career in gardening. Which, interestingly enough, I'd known nothing about, but had felt drawn to. And I think in hindsight, that was one way that I was trying to pursue this interest in creativity, in growing and creating and designing. And it was a great counterfoil to the kind of practicality and creativity of gardening to that scientific, academic background. And that opened up more creative doors, in the sense it was when I, as I became a gardener, that I also came across Cambridge Community Circus. And that was something I'd never done any kind of acrobatics or even performing actually before then. But I happened upon them and it piqued my interest, and I went along and started out learning trapeze. And that was a real revelation for me, because it was the first time I had this sense of play again, of doing a thing where I didn't have any expectations of myself, but I was instinctively drawn and had an instinctive enthusiasm for it. And so it reminded me of that, being in a playground again and just doing things for the fun of having a go rather than a need to excel. So I then started a journey it's probably been 10 years now of being of training circus arts, acro balance, an aerial hoop, but always on the side as a hobby. Moved into teaching and performing. And so I think what was happening in all of these things, that I was getting closer to what I really wanted to do deep down, but still dithering around the edges of the writing.
fascinating. But tell me, when did you get the idea, or where did you get the idea that being of service required something that was, I don't know, what did you think being of service required? Because you said you went the more scientific route and you went into something to do with, epidemiology and all of that. Mm. What gave you that idea that was a being of service as opposed to teaching acrobatic circus stuff with people or writing? What gave you that idea?
I think growing up, my role in the family was to be a practical and caring help and support to my mother, who was a single parent with three children at home, struggling financially and with a lot of challenges herself. And as the only girl, I became I filled that supportive role. There wasn't a partner in the house. She didn't have a partner there. And so I think I began to believe that that's where my value was in that kind of being a practical service somehow. And that's where my worth was. I don't remember anyone explicitly discouraging me from being creative or telling me. I do have one memory of somebody, a man on holiday, scoffing at my idea. It was the one and only time I admitted to wanting to be a writer, and scoffing at that as being a pipe dream, and that I was, being very unrealistic. But at home, I was never really discouraged, but it wasn't where the validation came. And I was desperate to feel that I was earning my place in the world at that time. And I didn't, for whatever reasons, it's difficult to see now, but for whatever reasons, I didn't believe at that time that creativity was earning my place. Having said that, I admired it hugely in others and always have. Because part of me obviously did believe.
Yeah, you said that you read very, very avidly, and therefore creativity in writing was giving you something. So you admired it in others, but it didn't make the leap across.
No, somehow that didn't apply to me. I didn't feel that was allowed for me. I'm not quite sure why, to be honest, but it wasn't, and still is in some ways, a strong belief. I suppose it's also an assertion of self-belief to create something and put it out there. There's almost an implicit statement that I therefore believe other people will this will be of value to other people. And I think that was something I found very hard to, what's the word, to believe.
However, then you said about the circus, so there is the position of just doing something for the fun of doing it. So
yes,
the circus work, you found that you were playing again, and you ended up doing teaching as well. But the how did that sit with you? Did that start to open a possibility of playing and having fun for yourself rather than it having to be to do with being of any use?
it did. And at the beginning, there was a real euphoria in that and a real joy in the freedom of, I don't have to be good at this. And I don't know why I was able to say that to myself in that context. But it was a great feeling. And it was a community of people where it was all about encouraging each other and supporting each other just to have a go, just to try, and not with a mindset of, you have to excel or you have to achieve a certain standard. I think partly because it was a community circus, so there was no kind of professional aspirations necessarily. It was about bringing the joy of circus to everyone in a cost-effective way. But what's interesting is as I tend to be quite an all or nothing person, so if I apply myself to something, I'll do it wholeheartedly. And as I became better and better and more skillful in what I was doing, my relationship to it changed. And I then found that I was setting expectations and standards on myself that started to limit my own joy in it. And that was quite a difficult realization to come to, that I was almost spoiling it for myself.
And did you see any link there to the orientation of your life, of it having to be kind of first class honours? Because Claire got double first class honours. I couldn't resist. You see, Claire, I said I'd say your own CV. But this is it. Your application and your drive achieved you double first class honours at Oxford University, and yet that, you're saying to us, that wasn't really what you wanted to be doing.
No. And I think that drive to excel was again motivated hugely by fear. So there's a fear that if I'm not brilliant at something, I'm not safe.
Interesting. So then that crossed over to the circus.
Yes. And that was painful to realise that's what happened, because the circus for me represented a place of freedom and a sense of, oh, I've managed to escape that path and that compulsion that I have to, if I'm going to do it, I've got to be the best. That's not what I believe, but I've got to do the absolute best I possibly can, and somehow it's not worth it unless I've excelled. And it's interesting because even when I did excel in academically, I still never felt safe. And I was one of those incredibly irritating people who after every exam was convinced I'd failed. And looking back, I'm not sure how anyone tolerated me. But I did truly believe that I'd done very badly and that it was going to be a disaster.
I know, and so people tolerated you, Claire, because you're absolutely lovely. And you believed it. If you believed it, you believed
it.
That's what's interesting listening to you, that you said at the beginning something that was interesting to me, which the journey brings you to where it's going to bring you. I'm not sure that journeys do bring us. I think what you're doing now is coming from absolutely huge courage at looking in and seeing that you weren't happy. The courage to stop your PhD was enormous, right? As you said, almost at the last hurdle. Yeah. I've witnessed an awful lot of people in life who actually do live all their lives by default. So their journey actually does just act out of that belief that you're sharing with us about this is what's needed. And I think lots of people have lived. The fact that you are jumping off, or you did jump off, it's very interesting. She started to challenge your own beliefs, and even though it arose again with the circus. I'm also interested then, you'd started, hadn't you? So something, there was a, yes, a shift.
Something was shifting, yes.
So tell us about the gardening then, because that, did you try and do that to an absolutely top level as well?
Ooh, no, I didn't. And I, again, when I first went into the gardening, I had that sense of freedom that I did with the circus of, oh, how wonderful, I'm in this arena now where I don't have to excel. And actually gardening, I suppose, unless you get into the higher echelons of kind of garden design, it's such an earthy profession, and so much of it is just about day-to-day care that it's almost against the ethos to be trying to excel at it, because it's an act of nurture and of and so at the beginning that felt like a real liberation. And it was interesting because I plunged into it with zero knowledge or ability or experience, in fact. And quite quickly, somehow doors opened, I think because of my enthusiasm. And I found myself fairly quickly as the deputy head gardener at one of the Cambridge colleges. Well, interestingly, the same Cambridge college that I had been doing my PhD at. So I think some of my fellow students were slightly bewildered to see me in the gardens with mowing machines. but I think what began to happen with the gardening was a realization it was a step in the right direction, but it wasn't exactly where I wanted to be. And so I didn't start to strive towards higher goals in that area. And that in itself was uncomfortable, to think, why am I not trying to excel? Yeah. And that felt difficult to, I suppose I thought in that sense, something's wrong. Why am I not pushing to be the best?
Yeah, so something was changing. Something was changing.
Yes,
Again, that, were you in that time that you were gardening? How long was that? Eight years? Have I got that?
And it's about nine years I was gardening for.
So in that time, was your writing happening?
No. So I had dabbled a tiny bit during my PhD in trying a bit of science writing, and actually with that I did have success. I won a prize in the Guardian science writing competition. I can't remember quite what it's called. But it was very tentative, and for some reason I didn't really follow through with that. I think, again, because it was science-based and I moved away. And I, by that point, for most of my life, I had continuously written, but by that point I'd completely abandoned it for the most part. And I could feel the urge there. But I think I became more and more afraid of going anywhere near it, because I nurtured it like this. It's a bit like, the only way I can explain it, it was a kind of secret desire, and I was terrified of admitting it to anybody. And it felt like if I actually, it's like having a gestating a baby, and while it's still inside, it's safe and nothing can harm it. And although of course you want to give birth and you want to this dream to manifest, there's risks associated with that. Once the dream's in the outside world, you don't have control over what happens to it. And so there's a fear, or there was for me, a real fear of, what if it doesn't make it? Survive,
especially given everything that you shared with us, that if you had a big set of very strong beliefs about having to do something absolutely to a high level, then of course it's a huge thing, isn't it? So what's made the difference then? Because you are writing now, you've finished gardening, you are writing. So what changed?
Well, several things, one of which was during my 20s, when I had first started the PhD, I had a lot of difficulties with depression, which of course was a manifestation of the fact I was not in the place I really wanted to be, as well as other things. And I had started taking antidepressants at that point, and that continued for 13 years. And interestingly, around the time, so it must be over 2 years ago now, something that we'd had a change in our family dynamics that had brought things to a head for me. And I made this decision, which I don't advise anyone else ever do, to come off these tablets. And I did it quite suddenly, which of course you should never ever do. And I think it was a part of me that felt it was time to be myself and find myself. And I think in a way, the tablets, I think they have they're an amazing support for at certain times of life. But by that point, they were holding me back in a way. This is in my personal journey, because I wasn't going into that place I needed to. And what happened after that was a huge crisis, which in hindsight is not surprising, that led me to get to the point where I thought, something has really got to change now. And interestingly, out of that crisis, in the middle of that crisis, first of all, I met my current boyfriend, Johnny, and have since been in the most growthful, supportive and healthy relationship I've ever been. And secondly, through Johnny, I came to start working with you, Julia.
Which was a delight to meet you. January or
so. Yes. Yeah. And so from a time in my life that I thought was an absolute disaster and was terrifying, absolutely terrifying, I have to say, I was having severe panic attacks and anxiety. I found, things, circumstances configured in such a way that I began to, there was a platform for me to begin, well, I suppose, reorientating myself to my own life. And I had the support around me to begin doing that, which is an ongoing journey. I mean, it's interesting because in trying to decide whether to do this podcast, there was the fearful part of me thinking, well, you know, how on earth can I do a podcast? Because I haven't arrived anywhere yet. I haven't achieved, and I don't have some shiny product to say I've done it. But of course that's life, actually. It's the journey. And I realized, I read something this morning actually about, it said our mess is our message. And this idea that actually it's the process, and sharing the process that can be very empowering and helpful to other people. And and so it's okay that I'm still in that chrysalis period, and that there are still big wobbles and times where I need the support. But I'm slowly finding my way.
It's amazing. You're definitely finding your way, Claire. Your blog is awesome, because that was a big step, because you did leave your job, you did start writing, you then locked down, so you obviously were in a space where you had the writer's life. But your blog, so tell us about how, because Claire's blog is called Sold You. I said it back to front. It's beautiful. And do go and read it. It's soldu. What's the actual link? I mean, I'll put it below, but it's
.co.uk.
.co.uk. And so how has that been birthed? Because you are now actually putting your writing out for people to read. It isn't just something, because you started and you were writing and you were doing it for yourself. But how has it come that you put it out?
Mostly through you, Julia. So I vividly remember the moment in a session talking with you where I admitted we'd gone through the journey of me leaving my work and everything else that happened since, and then finally we got to this point where you asked me, you know, now what is it that you want to do? And even in that incredibly safe space, the terror of admitting I think I want to write was very, very challenging. And that was a session where you suggested that maybe a good place to start would be a blog, which funnily enough, I had never considered before. And at that point, I had been writing every day for 2 years, which was a result of two things. That was a result of my boyfriend, Johnny, first of all, suggested it. Although interestingly, he suggested it because he found it very helpful himself at various times. And secondly, somebody had happened to send me the book The Artist's Way. And Julia Cameron in that book puts great emphasis on this practice of what she calls morning pages. And the minute I started, everything changed. So once I was writing every day, yeah, everything changed, and it became a thing that I really ran with, but only for myself. Nobody ever saw what I wrote. So when you suggested the blog, it came as a bit of a surprise, because as I said, I think I'd always thought about writing books or articles perhaps, but I'd never really thought about a blog. And so I went away thinking, yeah, that's a great idea. And found it really hard. And I think because a blog really is what's going on for you at the time. It's a kind of moment by moment snapshot of a life. And of course, what was going on for me was enormous fear and confronting a lot of these deepest vulnerabilities in me. And so I began to realize, well, if I'm going to do it, that really is the only thing I can write about right now, because it's the biggest thing that's happening for me. But that feels like stripping naked publicly and bearing your soul to the world, which was funny because of course when I first set it up, it wasn't necessarily that anybody would ever read it, but there was something very symbolic about putting it out there for the first time, writing something and going, right, I'm willing to share this, even though it's absolutely terrifying for me. So that was the birthing process itself was very painful and involved a huge amount of fear.
But now you're doing it and you've written quite a few entries. Is there still fear, or has it changed? What's going on now?
It's still a process, definitely. There, once that, nothing has been like that first entry. The first entry was, I really had to face myself in that very first blog post. After that, it started to flow a bit more freely. But with each one, there's still those voices that come up and a fear that I might have said something that could offend someone, or have I been, I like to use metaphors a lot, and there's always a fear, oh, is it too much? But I think the only way I've been able to do it is to see it as, I'm not trying to do it for anyone, I'm just practicing expressing myself without fear, and however that lands with people, that's okay, and that's what I'm working with, is just allowing that to be as it is. But I find that with every post, it's a process, and I have to be, well, I don't have to, I choose to try and be very present with all of those things that come up, and be vigilant about the voice of doubt that wants me to take that post back down, which still happens, and I think probably will for quite a while.
Well done. But it sounds like you are able to witness the voices, which is the space of connecting more to your expression and being able to see the voices apart from you rather than them being you.
Yes, I'm getting better at it. It's a practice, and this is an ideal workshop. The word you often use, Julia, which I find so helpful, in that every time I do put up a blog post, I'm aware that's part of it, and I'm welcoming that opportunity to hear the voices that come up, to listen to what the fearful mind talk is saying, and to remind myself those aren't truths. They're the part of me that's afraid and still trying to return to the default settings. And so my job is just to watch them and speak to them sometimes, and reassure them it's okay. Nothing terrible is going to happen here. Sometimes I'm good at that. Sometimes I'm not so good.
as you said, it's a chrysalis. You're in the chrysalis, but you're on the journey. And I think what you've shared is awesome for everybody, anyone who's listening. It's really, really interesting that you started to say that you wanted to be of service and make a difference. And actually, just by sharing what you've shared today, I think will make a lot of difference. But is there any last thing you'd like to share, either of yourself or offer anything to our listeners before
we finish? Well, I suppose in this journey and where I've got to get today, one of the most helpful ways I've found of engaging with my own mind is this idea of thinking of it as a car with a load of children on the back seat. And you know, sometimes those children can, on a long journey, can get very rowdy and crotchety and demanding attention. And in the past, I've therefore let them come into the front seat and grab hold of the wheel, and they've been driving the car. And of course, if you do that, you end up you don't end up going anywhere that you really wanted to. The solution isn't necessarily to therefore put them all in a boot and slam it shut and try and pretend they're not there, but actually to stop that car sometimes and speak to those fearful crotchety children in a compassionate and understanding voice, and let them be there, but just calm it down and then continue on the journey. And that's the thing I try and remind myself of every time that chorus of shouty voices comes up. And so to anyone who's embarking on something where there's a lot of fear, but they really want to do it, I'd offer up that.
I love it. I absolutely, you said that metaphor is something you love to use in your work. And that metaphor is awesome. I'll be using it. You'll see, I'll be telling people their workshops, but no, that's so fabulous. What a fabulous interview, a lovely fabulous conversation with you. I have so enjoyed it, and thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Julia. I've very much enjoyed it too, and thank you for all your help on this journey as well.
Thank you for joining us. If you would like to be a part of our community, please join my Facebook group, Conversations with a Bodhisattva.